Thanks a lot, Neil, and thanks to everyone for signing in. I'm going to speak on behalf of the CHIME collaboration about our first cosmology science results, or I should say the first 21 centimeter science results, which take the form of a cross correlation between 21 centimeter maps from CHIME and galaxy and quasar positions measured by the EBOS survey. As Neil mentioned, I was one of the co-leaders of this analysis, but I should start right away by giving huge credit to a large number of other people in the CHIME collaboration, because this work is the product of many years of work by many people, and in particular, a lot of work on designing and building the telescope and also coming up with analysis methods that have allowed us to reach this first milestone. So in this talk, I'm going to start with a very brief review of 21 centimeter intensity mapping, because I expect that most people on the call are roughly familiar with the concept. And also show some motivational plots, which tell you why an instrument like CHIME might be useful for cosmology. And from there, I'll go into a more detailed overview of the CHIME instrument, how it's designed and how certain features of that design map onto different aspects of cosmological measurements. I'll briefly talk about the telescope's operational status. From there, I'll go into this new analysis, which we put on the archive about a month ago. I'll first talk about the data processing on the CHIME side in particular that went into this analysis, and then I'll go through our physical interpretation of these results. So just to get started, the goal of the technique of 21 centimeter intensity mapping is to map out large scale structure, essentially the same goal of a photometric or spectroscopic galaxy survey, but using a different technique. In 21 centimeter intensity mapping, we observe the sky at reasonably low angular resolution in the radio at frequencies less than about 1.4 gigahertz. The resulting sky maps will contain 21 centimeter line emission from spin flips in neutral hydrogen. And we know that after reionization, the vast majority of this neutral hydrogen is locked inside of galaxies. And so by looking at the fluctuations in 21 centimeter maps we make, we can relate those to the distribution of galaxies as traced by their emission in 21 centimeter. Furthermore, we can also make a map as a function of redshift or distance away from us, because we know the rest frequency of the 21 centimeter line. If we measure fluctuations in maps at a lower frequency than this, we can immediately relate that to a redshift and then to a line of sight distance. And so in this way, we can fill out a three-dimensional view of large-scale structure, a cartoon of which is shown on the right. You can contrast this with what you do in a spectroscopic galaxy survey, where instead of trying to map the emission from many galaxies in aggregate, you instead look for galaxies one by one in imaging and then through certain features of their spectra. And so just flipping between these two cartoons, you can see that there is a lot of complementarity here, where spectroscopic surveys can in principle probe both very fine grain structure and larger scale structure. On the 21 centimeter side, we're much more limited to larger angular scales. However, our mapping speed is much higher because we don't need to count galaxies one by one. We instead just target these large scales directly. And so there's a lot of complementarity between these two techniques, which I think will be interesting to exploit moving forward. Now, by way of motivation for an instrument like CHIME, I can show you a plot of state-of-the-art measurements of cosmic expansion history. These are measurements from four different samples from the EBOS survey, plotted in terms of this volume average distance measure as a ratio to a fiducial model from Planck as a function of redshift. And we can contrast these current measurements with what you might expect from CHIME in the absence of any foregrounds or systematics. And so this is an updated forecast that we just released in our instrument overview paper with the same redshift binning as forecast for DESI, which I'll show in a second. And so just at the zeroth order level, by flipping in between these two panels, you can see that if we can control the foregrounds and systematics appropriately in CHIME, then in principle, very exciting measurements of expansion history are possible over a wide redshift range. However, the challenge that we're facing now and that we're working very hard on is to try and realize this potential, this statistical potential of CHIME, in order to control all of these other effects in the instrument and in the sky signal in order to recover this information. Now, we can also look at forecasts from DESI. These darker error bars here were recomputed within the same forecasting formalism as the orange bars, whereas the blue Lyman alpha forecasts were not recomputed. They were just taken from an existing paper in the literature. And so here you can see that over a wide redshift range, these forecasts are roughly comparable. In a certain range, we would expect the statistical precision of chime to be better than DESI. This is just for 1 year of clean chime integration time. However, again, the point of these orange error bars is not to give you a surefire expectation for what chime will achieve in the next n years. It's rather to show you the potential of chime and a much lower cost and a higher mapping speed experiment in making interesting measurements of BAO. And you can play the same game for other kinds of cosmological forecasts, and you can get some similarly exciting results there. Yes, so I see Suvidi raised a hand.
Hi, Simon. I have a question regarding the error bar. So how much information is there in the radial in comparison to the transverse for 20 centimeter in chime?
Good. That's a good question. We haven't actually done the forecast where we split out the radial and the transverse directions. Just off the top of my head, I would guess that there's more information in the transverse direction, just because you're measuring, you know, the 2D modes on the sky instead of the 1D modes along the line of sight. But I can't say too much beyond that because we haven't attempted to quantify that.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Okay. So with this motivation in mind, let me go into more detail about the standard itself.
Yeah. Simon, I don't know if I missed it. Did you say the time when we're going to see these error bars?
No, I was careful not to say a time.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So maybe I'll come back to this a bit at the end of the talk and talk about some of the things that we're focusing on as a next step after the stacking analysis.
Okay, thanks.
So at this point, I'll go into a bit more detail about what chime is and how its design relates to this cosmology goal. So as many of you know, the chime acronym stands for the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. Chime was designed as a compact radio interferometer with many redundant baselines. In particular, it's composed of 1,024 antennas, each consisting of two polarized feeds, which are distributed between four cylindrical parabolic reflectors, and the feeds hang upside down from each one of these walkways at the focus of each cylinder. The cylinders are 20 meters wide by 100 meters long, and are all oriented in the north-south direction. Chime observes frequencies from 400 to 800 megahertz, which in redshift to 21 centimeter maps onto redshift 2.5 down to redshift 0.8, and this band is split into 1,024 channels, each of which corresponds to a narrow redshift bin for 21 centimeter. Now, each one of these pieces of jargon on the slide is motivated by a particular aspect of cosmological measurements that we would like to make. And so let me go through this relationship now. First of all, chime was designed to make use of the technique of interferometry, meaning for cosmology, at least, we mostly don't use the response of a single feed or a single antenna to the sky. Instead, we synthesize observations from pairs of feeds, say feed A and feed B here, and manipulate them using the technique of radio interferometry to map out single Fourier modes on the sky. Right? You can show that there's a fairly direct comparison between the so-called baseline distance, that is the distance between two feeds A and B, and the Fourier mode transverse to the line of sight that you're measuring. So feeds which are separated by longer distances or so-called longer baselines are mapping higher K modes or smaller angular scales. Feeds which are closer together or shorter baselines are mapping low K and large angular scales. Chime was designed to be compact, meaning that the feeds are packed fairly closely together along each one of these focal lines, such that we have access to many short baselines, which allows us to measure large scales or low K on the sky. Chime is also designed to have many redundant baseline pairs, meaning that there are many pairs of feeds with the same interfeed distance and the same orientation on the ground. Each one of these redundant baselines will be measuring the same Fourier mode on the sky, but with a different realization of the noise. And so by co-adding groups of redundant baselines, we can beat down the noise and obtain higher fidelity measurements of individual modes on the sky. Finally, Chime's frequency channelization corresponds to a fairly high redshift resolution. So the frequency channel width of about 390 kilohertz corresponds to a redshift resolution of order 10 to the minus 3, which is comparable to what you get from modern spectroscopic surveys. So despite the fact I said at the beginning that Chime's angular resolution is fairly coarse, its redshift resolution is actually fairly fine. And this can have interesting implications for the kinds of physics that you can measure in cosmology. And so I'll mention that briefly towards the end. So geographically, if you look on this accurate map of Canada, Chime is located here in the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia at the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory. This is a federally operated radio astronomy site, which existed for many decades before Chime was built. And we've been able to take advantage of the personnel and the existing infrastructure at this site to continue running Chime. I think I saw a raised hand.
Yeah, that's me. I have a question about the telescope. I was just wondering, is there whether there's a reason why the telescopes are in cylindrical shape instead of the regular, you know, kind of spherical shape?
Yeah, that's a good question. It essentially comes down to the field of view of the telescope. Having these wide cylinders allows us to view a large patch of the sky at a given time. And this is very useful in particular for monitoring radio transients or discovering radio transients like fast radio bursts and pulsars. If you're searching for something or you want to make sure you see it every day, then it's very useful to have such a wide field of view on the sky. So in the end, this is the main advantage of these cylinders. There also can be some advantages for cosmology, just in terms of mapping speed and getting a wide view of the sky at each moment. And this was the original motivation for the cylinders. Now, it turns out there are some downsides to a cylinder design as opposed to a dish, which I won't talk about in detail, but in essence, because you have this long cylinder, you can have standing waves or reflections between the cylinder and the focal line, and this makes the beam response to the sky much more complicated. So there's definitely a trade-off between a cylinder versus a dish design, but this was the initial motivation for Chimes to have the wide field of view.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks. Right. So the Chime collaboration was originally formed from three Canadian universities, as well as the National Research Council of Canada, which operates the DRAO facility. And it has since expanded to include partners at several other places, including PI. We acknowledge that Chime is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Siliks Okanagan people, and we're grateful to live and work on these lands. If you travel to Chime in person, this is something like what you'll see. This is a drone flight, which was completed in 2016, just before the final construction of the telescope was finished. And this gives you a more up-close and personal view of the features of the telescope. The way things work in a nutshell is that radio signals come down off of the sky. They're focused by these cylindrical reflectors onto the radio receivers or feeds, which are suspended upside down from each one of these walkways. After some amplification, the feeds are carried into one of two shipping containers, one of which you can just see in between the cylinders here. These containers contain custom electronics, which digitize and channelize the signal. From there, the signals are sent into two other shipping containers, which you can't see here, but they're just on the opposite sides of the cylinders. And these contain banks of GPUs, which act to perform the correlations. That is, they take the signals from each pair of feeds and multiply them together and perform some averaging in time. So each one of these feed products, or so-called visibilities, is sensitive to a given Fourier mode on the sky. This data is then sent to the DRAO office buildings over here for short-term storage, and then it's sent to the CEDAR computer at Simon Fraser University, where we have a rolling allocation for longer-term storage and analysis. Chime has been taking cosmology data at full capacity for about 3 years, and we save just under 1 terabyte of data per day from the cosmology backend. Now, to think about the practical process of extracting cosmology from Chime's measurements, it's worthwhile to go through the relationship between what Chime actually measures, that is the product of these voltages or electric fields measured at two feeds, and the 21 centimeter sky signal. First of all, the sky contains not only 21 centimeter, but also bright foregrounds. These are dominated by synchrotron emission from electrons in the Milky Way and also bright extragalactic radio sources. In addition, there's also man-made radio frequency interference from things like cell phones and TV stations and nearby machinery. Some of this is persistent in time, so we can make a static frequency mask to flag it out. But there's a lot of other RFI, which is transient, which pops in and out of the data. And so we need ways to flag this and remove it in a combination of real time and also after the fact analysis. These signals are all multiplied by a phase or delay factor, which you can interpret as the time delay between when a signal from a given direction reaches feed A and feed B. And this is also convolved with the beam responses of feeds A and feed B to a signal coming from a given direction. On top of this, there's also thermal noise generated by various parts of the instrument and the signal chain. And finally, there's a complex gain factor associated with each feed related to amplification and signal loss, which is applied to the signal from a given feed as it transits through the signal chain and finally into digitization. And this single equation contains a lot of the complexity of 21 centimeter cosmology. The challenge that we face is that we need to understand or mitigate each item in this relationship with high precision in order to dig out the 21 centimeter signal that we're after. I won't talk too much more about the details of each one of these, except for the foregrounds, because this represents a significant problem, so it deserves a bit more discussion. Here is a plot which shows you the foreground problem in a fairly crisp way. This is a simulation of an example sight line that CHIM might observe over roughly the frequency range that CHIM is observing. These colored lines all denote simulations of different foreground signals, whereas this jagged black line denotes a simulation of the cosmological signal that we're after. Now, there are two main takeaways from this plot. The first is that the foregrounds are all much brighter than the signal. Taken together, these are between 4 and 5 orders of magnitude brighter than the signal that we're after. However, they all share the feature that they're very spectrally smooth. That is, they vary quite slowly with frequency along a given sight line. And so there are many different techniques that have been proposed to try and separate the foregrounds and the cosmological signal, but they all make use of this fact that the foregrounds are spectrally smooth, the cosmological signal is not, and so we hope that we can project our data into some space where we can make a clean separation between the spectrally smooth foregrounds and the spectrally unsmooth 21 centimeter signal. And there's a specific technique that we implemented in this cross-correlation analysis, and I'll talk about that a bit later. Now, CHIM doesn't observe specific points on the sky directly. As I mentioned, CHIM essentially observes these Fourier modes on the sky, but there are various ways where you can transform these Fourier modes into sky maps. This is an example sky map where at each sample, at each 10-second sample that CHIM takes of the sky, we form a line of beams. That is, we form a line of manipulations of the data with localized angular response along the telescope meridian. And then we do this at each time sample. And so we line up all of these pixels on the sky from left to right, and we can form this into a sky map that you see here. So this is the map at 670 megahertz, which has fairly minimal processing applied. So you can see some of the dirty laundry that we have to deal with in this map. There are a few interesting features here. First, you can see the galactic plane, which in this projection comes in from the left, drops off the plot and then reappears on the right. You can also see several bright sources in the sky. The brightest during the daytime is the sun, and there are also a few of the other brightest radio sources that you can see. Each one of these sources is associated with a curve track, which is related to the source passing through the side lobes of the instrument. Due to the fact that CHIM is located at 49 degrees latitude, a source observed off meridian in the local telescope frame appears at a higher declination than a source observed on meridian. And so if you trace that through to the way the source looks in the map, you end up with these curved tracks as the source passes through the side lobes. And each one of these little dots on the track corresponds to a peak in the side lobes. The shapes of these tracks are frequency independent, but the actual location of the side lobes along them is frequency dependent. So if you flip through maps at multiple frequencies, you'll find that these dots contract and expand along these tracks. Another feature we have to deal with is aliasing. Due to the fact that we only sample the sky at a limited number of Fourier modes, once you inverse Fourier transform these modes to get a map of the sky, you end up with spatial aliasing, where within a certain range of declinations, you get repeated sky signals showing up at other locations. You can see this, for example, in the galactic plane here. There's an alias up here. Also, Virgo A, this bright point source, is aliased up here. Another interesting feature is the fact that CHIME actually observes the North Celestial Pole and a bit of sky on the other side of the North Celestial Pole to the standard transit. And so there are certain points on the sky that we actually see passing through the main beam twice. For example, CAS A here, it passes through the beam in one direction, and then it passes on the other side of the North Pole. And so we see an antipodal transit of it 180 degrees away. And then this antipodal transit is aliased down here. And so once you try and interpret the spatial features of the map, you need to keep all these different things in mind, that the CHIME observing strategy manipulates the sky in ways which you need to take care of, especially if you're using a map like this for cosmological analysis and you're trying to remove localized features in the map. Now, as I mentioned, CHIME has been collecting cosmology data for about 3 years, since October 2018. We've made a lot of progress on instrument calibration and characterization since that time. So I'm showing one example of that here. This is an example of the RFI environment throughout the CHIME band. And currently we find that about 42% of the band is flagged due to RFI. This number is very gradually creeping up as more and more cell phone bands turn on, but it's still, this is the rough number that you should keep in mind. And there are a few features that you can identify here. So this group of RFI here is related to cell phone LTE bands. This spike at 690 megahertz is related to one of the electronics on a nearby radio telescope. These 6 megahertz bands here are different over-the-air TV stations. And down here, these are UHF repeaters, which are designed to amplify the signals for shortwave radios over longer ranges. Everything I'm showing here is, there might be some transient RFI here, but the larger features in this plot are persistent in time, so they're always masked in the data. But on top of this, there's a lot of other transient RFI, particularly at lower frequencies, that we need to work to remove. Now, there's some other statistics here, which I won't go into in detail, but if you are interested in the details, we recently released this instrument overview paper, which contains a lot more description of how we calibrate the instrument and the current status of that. So at this point, let me transition into talking about this new analysis that we just put on the archive. This takes the form of a cross-correlation between sky maps, similar to what I just showed, and galaxy and quasar catalogs from EBOS. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with the EBOS survey. This is a long large-scale structure survey which recently completed with the Sloan Telescope and released its final results and data last year. For a cross-correlation with CHIME, we make use of 3 catalogs of objects, the emission line galaxies, excuse me, the luminous red galaxies, and the quasar catalog, not the quasars that are used for Lyman alpha studies, but the quasars that are used for clustering. This bottom panel here shows histograms of the redshift distributions of each one of these 3 samples, with redshift on the lower x-axis and then equivalent 21 centimeter frequency on the upper x-axis. In dark gray on this side is a range which is not observed by CHIME, so obviously we don't use that. The range we do use for this analysis is located in between these 2 black bars. This is due to a much cleaner data in this range than at lower frequencies, mostly due to RFI. These gray bands denote persistent RFI bands, which are flagged out. And you can see there's many more here. And beyond that, like I mentioned before, there's also a lot more transient RFI in this band, which we're working on filtering out. But in the near term, there was a clear band from roughly 585 to 800 megahertz that we focused on for this analysis. Here is an example CHIME sky map overlaid with the footprints of EBOS that we use for this analysis. EBOS observes in two main regions, the North Galactic Cap and the South Galactic Cap. However, we found higher sensitivity to the cross-correlation in the North Galactic Cap due to the cleaner nature of CHIME data in this range. And so in our paper, we only present a detailed analysis of the North Galactic Cap. The quasars and LRGs cover around 2,500 square degrees, and the ELGs cover a much smaller patch, around 550 square degrees, but this is still sufficient to make a measurement of the cross-correlation with CHIME. Now, to implement this cross-correlation, we make use of a spectral stacking method, which I'll go through here. We first start and form the CHIME observations into a multi-frequency sky map. We apply various filtering and masking operations to this map. And then we take the location and the equivalent 21 centimeter frequency of each object in a given EBOS catalog, and we extract a spectral cube from our CHIME map centered on that location. We take each spectral cube and we shift its frequency axis such that the zero point is aligned. And then we stack, we average all of these down. An example of this just in 1D as a function of redshift or frequency is shown here. So what we expect to see in a 1D stacking profile is a peak at zero lag corresponding to 21 centimeter emission from the objects and also from nearby objects which contain 21 centimeter or contain H1. We expect to see a smooth fall off related to the 1D correlation function between H1 and the tracers we're correlating against. And at sufficiently high lag, we expect the signal to disappear into the noise. Now, this is not the first time that this kind of analysis has been performed for 21 centimeter. In particular, there are two previous classes of measurements, which are both relevant for interpreting what we've done with CHIME. And so let me talk about those. Yes, question from Matt.
Yeah, just before you go on, what does it mean to extract a spectral cube? And kind of in general, are you basically just building a template for what you expect to see from the EBOS locations and redshifts? Or
it's not quite a template. So this is somewhat fancy language to say we have we make our CHIME map. And so we have a map in terms of RA deck and frequency or redshift. And we just take a small chunk of that map centered on each object. And then we stack down.
And the shift is based on the expected redshift of the object, or what is the shift about?
Yeah, the shift is, so if we only had a 2D map, we would just take, you know, the small region of the map located at each object and stack that down to get a 2D stacking profile. But in 3D, we also need to make sure we're stacking on the locations of the objects in the redshift direction. And so this is what we do here. We just take each little cube from this object and we make sure that we shift the coordinates such that the zero point of the coordinates is located at the location of the object, both in angular direction and in frequency or redshift. And then we stack.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you stack in terms of like angular separation or in terms of like, you know, like distance, megaparsecs?
We stack in terms of angular separation.
Yeah, okay. Like, is there a reason not to rescale the angular coordinates, you know, to make it like, you know, stacking in terms of like, you know, fixed co-moving separation?
Yeah, the overall motivation as well for choosing this technique is to try and do the minimal amount of operations to the data. Since in this analysis, we expected the statistical precision on interesting cosmology to not be super high, at least in terms of constraining new things. And so the focus here was really on just developing robust analysis techniques and making sure that those are robust, and then just kind of forward modeling everything else. So like the fact that we don't rescale to be in terms of transverse distance, we just forward model that with simulations.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, I think there's another question.
Hey, so how do you model the uncertainty on the measurements, error bars?
Good. Let me think about whether I want to answer this now or later. I would say there's a large number of sources of uncertainty that we try and account for. So some of these are done based on validation tests of testing for consistency between different polarizations of the data or different jackknives. Mm-hmm. And there are various other tests we do like that. Also possible systematic redshift errors or redshift uncertainties in the EBOS catalogs we factor in. However, the dominant source of uncertainty that we find in the end is due to uncertainty in the modeling on nonlinear scales. So I'll talk a bit more about this later on.
Okay.
And then maybe we can follow up if it's still. Yeah. Great. Okay. So like I said, there are two previous types of measurements which are relevant for interpreting what we've done with time. So the first type is again spectral stacking, exactly what I've described here. But in the past, it's usually been performed with interferometers with much higher angular resolution or smaller beams than Chime. So these measurements have been made most famously with GMRT. There have been a number of analyses here. And these measurements have been made between 4 and 30 sigma significance in terms of a measurement of 21 centimeter emission. However, the beams of instruments like GMRT are so small that they're not probing any clustering information about the H1. Instead, the vast majority of their information is just how much 21 centimeter emission is coming from the catalog objects themselves. So they can take, essentially they measure a mean 21 centimeter flux for their catalog objects, and they can translate that into a mean H1 mass of the galaxy sample. Now the second class of previous analysis is more cosmological, or more similar to what we think about in other areas of cosmology. This type of analysis was much more commonly performed with single dish observations, like from the Green Bank telescope. And instead of doing stacking here, what's typically been done is to measure a cross power spectrum between a map of galaxy positions and a 21 centimeter sky map. These cross power spectra have been measured between 4 and 7 sigma significance. And the theoretical interpretation is typically in the form of a fixed template for the scale dependence of the cross power spectrum with a single free amplitude, which is just scaled up and down and fit to data. And with the precision of these analyses, this single parameter fit is sufficient to provide a good fit to the data in most cases. So an example here is shown in this upper panel. The theory template is shown by the thin staircase here, and then the amplitude of the staircase is left afloat and fit to the data. Now, Chime's analysis falls somewhere in between these two classes. So on the one hand, we do perform a stacking analysis, so it's more similar to these GMRT observations. However, our synthesized beam is much larger than GMRT. It's more similar to GBT. So in that sense, we have much more information that we're recovering about the clustering of H1 as opposed to just the H1 content of each object. So with this context in mind, I'll show you some of the steps that we go through in processing the Chime data. So this is again an example sky map at 700 megahertz, now zoomed into a region of the sky which is relevant for the EBOS NGC field. This map has been made from roughly 500 hours or 22 days of clean integration time, which comes after a whole lot of data quality checks and flags have been implemented. And in this map, there's also an approximate deconvolution of a model for the primary beam, in particular for the main lobe of the beam. And so you can see here, you can see all these horizontal lines. These are indicating that the beam has not been completely deconvolved. Each one of these points on the side of the main point is related to an east-west side lobe of the synthesized beam corresponding to the map. But there are a lot of other frequency-dependent effects which have been approximately deconvolved from this map. And this helps with foreground separation from 21 centimeter. The chief features you can see in this map are diffuse galactic emission, which stretches diagonally across it, and also many of these bright radio sources, which show up as these horizontal lines with the side lobes. And so our goal in looking at this map is to filter out these two main sources of cosmological emission or foregrounds, the diffuse emission and then the point sources. To filter out the diffuse emission, we remake this map, but exclude baselines formed from feeds which are within the same cylinder. So now restricting to the so-called intercylinder baselines, we end up with a map like this. So the idea behind this technique is that, like I said before, shorter baselines are sensitive to larger angular scales on the sky. And a lot of this diffuse galactic emission lives at larger angular scales. And so by removing this information from the map and only retaining long baselines or smaller angular scales, we can get rid of a lot of this diffuse emission. And you can see in this map, a lot of the diffuse patterns here have disappeared. And now we're just dominated by radio point sources. The next filtering step makes use of the fact that these point sources are known to be very spectrally smooth, or their spectra are very spectrally smooth. So we attempt to remove spectrally smooth modes from the map in the frequency direction. To do this, we take the map and we Fourier transform along the frequency axis of each angular pixel. So this converts from frequency to its Fourier conjugate delay with units of time. And then we take this Fourier transform and we compute the variance over array over the x-axis of this map. And so we end up with essentially a power spectrum as a function of declination in the map. And it's a power spectrum along the frequency direction. And now we can look at this power spectrum called a delay spectrum, and we can see some interesting features which guide us in how to move forward. I'm plotting here the delay spectrum normalized by the delay spectrum of a realization of the expected thermal noise. So you're seeing the ratio of the power within the map to what's expected from the thermal noise. And in this map, you can see several interesting features. Since all of the foregrounds are expected to be spectrally smooth, if we had a perfect instrument or perfect analysis procedure, we would expect the foregrounds to all be confined to this narrow strip close to zero delay, which corresponds to very slowly varying modes and frequency. However, we don't live in a perfect world, at least yet, in terms of time analysis. And so these spectrally smooth foregrounds tend to spread out to higher delays. There are a few different reasons for this that we can identify visually in this map. First of all, you can see these vertical stripes at 30 nanoseconds, roughly 60 nanoseconds, 90 nanoseconds. And that's probably all you can see visually in this map. These come from reflections of the signal between the cylinder and the focal line, as I mentioned earlier. So there's a 5 meter distance between the focal line and the cylinder. And if you translate this into a round trip light travel time between the cylinder and the focal line, you end up with roughly 30 nanoseconds. And so you can see we get copies of the foregrounds at harmonics of 30 nanoseconds. And these show up cleanly in this plot. You can also see some curved tracks here. Again, these are related to bright sources passing through the far side lobes. If we have perfect beam knowledge, including the side lobes, in principle, we can deconvolve these point sources. But currently, we don't have that perfect knowledge. And so we still see some residuals of these sources. However, if you look at sufficiently high delays, then you start to notice a much cleaner regime where the power in the map becomes quite close to the expected noise power, just based on our integration time and thermal noise in the instrument. And so the way we move forward is we identify a region where the ratio of data power to noise power is less than roughly a factor of 3, right? So that's represented by this, this dashed line here. Now, if you move just a bit in from this cut, you'll find that the dominant features are these curved tracks related to point sources. And we found that some of these tracks, at least the tracks out here, can be efficiently removed by just locally masking some of these point sources in the map. And so because of this, in the end, we use a more aggressive delay cut than this dashed line. We subtract 75 nanoseconds from it, and we use this solid line here. So after identifying this cut, we just apply essentially a high-pass filter along the frequency axis of each pixel to filter it out. And we make use of a specific technique from the 21 centimeter literature, which is designed to do this filtering, but also account for masking along the frequency axis that we have due to RFI and other sources of bad data. So now when we look back at our map, again, this has a lot of the diffuse emission filtered out, but it's still dominated by point sources. And if we apply this delay space filter on each pixel, we now end up with a map which looks like this. And now you can see there are large regions of this map which look essentially like noise. And you can do some statistics and compare to the to a noise realization and verify that these are quite close to the noise. Even this high-pass delay filter hasn't done a perfect job. You can still see artifacts in this map. The most noticeable ones are these huge curved tracks, which are again related to the spectra of the brightest radio sources. For the four brightest radio sources in the sky, there's an approximate peeling procedure that's been implemented before this, which attempts to remove these signals from the map. However, again, this procedure isn't perfect, and at the level of precision we want, you can still find artifacts from these point sources. So the final step, we mask pixels in the map whose value is 6 times greater than the expected noise level. And this does a lot to mitigate the dominant parts of these artifacts. Even at this point, you'll notice that you can still see artifacts within this map. And this is something that we spent a lot of effort trying to tune for this analysis. In particular, you can consider a more aggressive pixel by pixel mask, and you can also consider a more aggressive cut in frequency delay space. However, we found that taking those cuts too aggressive starts to result in a significant drop of the signal to noise of the cross correlation with EBOS. And so we did some optimization and simulations in order to determine cuts which found a happy medium between signal loss in the cross correlation and just contamination of the data by some of these artifacts which are left. Yes, another question?
Thanks. So I have a question regarding the spatial variation. So do I understand correctly that you are not considering spatial variation in the foregrounds?
We don't explicitly use expected spatial variation of the foregrounds beyond kind of the broad considerations I've said here, that there's a lot of diffuse emission which can be filtered out by baseline cut. Yes. And then there's localized emission that spreads throughout the map from point sources in certain ways.
But that is not removed with the spatial fading model.
It's not, probably not in the sense that you're thinking of. There is, for the brightest point sources, you can essentially fit a model based on your knowledge of the instrument and how mm-hmm. you expect these curves tracks to look. You can fit an overall amplitude for the sources and try to remove the contribution from these tracks. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't do that, then you'd see really, really huge tracks here. But at the high precision we need to do this, we can't implement this technique perfectly yet, at least with the minimum of beam knowledge that we've applied. But this is the main spatial model for point sources. And then there's no real spatial information for galactic foregrounds that we've used, just simply because there aren't external models in this frequency range that are really precise enough to make use of this frequency range.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Great. Okay. So with this filtered and masked map in hand, we're now ready to perform the stacking on these catalogs from EBOS. So let me show an example of the stack in the angular direction evaluated at zero frequency lag. So in along the radial direction or along the frequency direction, this is the slice through the stack, which is it just located at the line of sight position of these objects. And this is for the quasar catalog. So immediately by eye, you can find an excess at the locations of these objects, which rises above the noise, which is off center from the objects. And if we take our knowledge of the synthesized beam, which goes into the map, fit a best fit model, and then subtract it, you find a residual which is consistent with noise. Now, I'm not showing any null tests in these slides, but we've done null tests and you can verify the statistical properties of this residual or what you would expect from the thermal noise in the observation. Now, if we take 1D slices in angular direction through this stack, and you compare the data for that slice in black with the best fit model, which is just a slice through this middle panel here, we find that the stacking signal that we get is consistent with an unresolved point source in the maps. And so for this region, when we try and interpret these stacks, we don't make use of the full three-dimensional information in the stack. Instead, we only use a one-dimensional frequency profile, a redshift profile, like I showed before. So we take each one of these 3D stacks, and we just take the pencil beam corresponding to the pixel at zero angular separation and just look at the stacking profile as a function of frequency. And so now I can show you the results for each one of these. So these are essentially a 1D correlation function as a function of radial distance translated into frequency, but averaged over, or I should say evaluated at the peak of the angular beam corresponding to these maps. The columns here show the results for the ELGs, LRGs, and quasars from EBOS. These black points are the data connected by lines to guide the eye. The red lines are the best fit model for the stacking signal. And these bands denote 68 and 95% error bars, essentially, which are made from stacking the Chi maps on many random mocks provided by the EBOS collaboration. And so if you subtract the best fit model from the data, again, you can do statistics and find that the residuals are consistent with what you get from the noise covariance based on the mocks. We obtain a signal to noise. We obtain significant detections of this cross-correlation for each catalog, so the signal to noise roughly 6, 7, and 11 for the ELGs, LRGs, and quasars, respectively. The quasar cross-correlation is close to the highest signal to noise measurement of cosmological 21 centimeter ever, not quite the highest signal to noise, but close. However, if you split the quasar catalog into three redshift bins, the highest bin has effective redshift 1.3, and this represents the highest redshift measurement of 21 centimeter thus far. You'll notice that the stacking profile has kind of a funny shape. This is related to the high pass filtering that we apply along a frequency axis. If there was no such filtering, you'd see just a smooth fall off here corresponding to the 1D cosmological correlation function. But this cutoff, essentially a hard cutoff in along the frequency axis, imprints a sync function-like shape onto this correlation. And so that's why you get these this scalloping feature here, and then some wiggles out to higher lag. So now in the last few minutes, I'll go through our attempts to physically interpret this signal. Now the physical interpretation is somewhat complicated due to the spatial scales that we end up being sensitive to after applying our filtering. So here is a plot oriented towards a cosmological perspective, which tries to encapsulate the scales we're sensitive to. On this plot, I'm showing k parallel, wave number transverse to the line of sight, and k perpendicular, sorry, k parallel on the, sorry, k parallel is on the y-axis, wave number along the line of sight, k perpendicular on the x-axis, transverse to the line of sight. And the sensitivity, or which scales we're sensitive to, varies with frequency or with redshift. So I'm plotting three different rectangles here corresponding to three different frequencies, which are within the range that we're probing this analysis. I've also plotted the maxima of the three lowest k BAO wiggles in the linear matter power spectrum. And so the first thing you find is if you compare these BAO wiggles to the range of scales that we're sensitive to, is that these two regions are completely disjoint. If you try and be a little more generous and say, and just look at where the quasi-linear regime is, where we might hope to do some perturbation theory interpretation of the results, again, you find that this region is mostly disjoint with the region that we end up being sensitive to in this analysis. Yes, Matt has a question.
Yeah, I guess I probably just missed it, but could you tell me again, because you're basically doing this stacking on the location of the EBOS objects, in what sense are you probing clustering? Because you did make some distinction between the previous observations and what you're doing now. Maybe could you just contrast them and explain how you're probing clustering and they weren't?
Sure, yeah. So it comes down to the fact that we are doing stacking, but we're dealing with a huge synthesized beam on the sky. So the width of a given beam in our maps is of order 10 megaparsecs or so, if you translate it into comoving distance. So we're not only getting the stacking profile of the H1 within each object. That's going to be like a tiny part of the beam, but we're also probing structures nearby, which are within this huge beam, which will then be correlated with the objects we're stacking on due to a large scale structure.
I see. Okay. Yeah, thanks. That's helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. I might actually show an extra slide after the talk is over, which will make this a little clearer. This is the basic point. I think I saw someone else might have had a question.
Yes, I have one. So when you're saying regarding that you centered the position of the new at the position of the quasar, and you are really at the small scales driven signal, how you take into account the RSD or the distortion due to the RSD in the frequency domain around the line of sight?
Good. So in the data, the RSD, it's let me try and think of the best way to answer that question. I think the essence of the question is that it's forward modeled. When I'll show you our model for the signal, we have some model for RSD related to both the H1 and the quasars. And so then we just propagate that through. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I told you that we've kind of filtered out our sensitivity to this BAO regime. And this is set by the specific choices we made for this analysis. The lowest K perpendicular we're sensitive to is related to the set of baselines that we exclude, which excludes the slowest varying modes on the sky. The lowest K parallel we're sensitive to is set by this high pass filter that we implement along the frequency axis. And so a key priority for the future will be to modify these filtering choices in order to recover more sensitivity to this quasi-linear regime, which is the ultimate goal of what we want to measure with CHIME. But in this analysis, our goal was just getting a robust measurement of 21 centimeter in a regime where we think the measurements are under control, even if it might be hard to model. And this is the situation we ended up with, where our physical signal to noise is concentrated at these highly nonlinear scales. And so we need to come up with a modeling approach to try and address that. So the approach that we take here makes use of the simulation infrastructure, which we developed for cosmology with CHIME. It's based on beginning with simulated maps of the H1 density and the galaxy density with the appropriate correlations between them. The H1 maps are propagated through an instrument model to generate a set of simulated visibilities. And we then take these and make a map, filter, and mask it the same way we do with the real data. While on the galaxy density side, we draw mock catalogs from this galaxy density, and then we stack our mock maps on these mock catalogs. And we do this many times in order to keep down variance in the result and obtain a prediction for the stacking signal. And we have an efficient procedure to do this as a function of the parameters in our signal model. It turns out that our model ends up being linear in many of these parameters, so we can effectively make different templates for the prediction and then assemble those multiplied by unknown parameters in such an efficient way that we can feed it into an MCNC and then get parameter constraints for this model. Now, there is work underway on a more efficient modeling technique where you can derive a transfer function which directly relates an underlying galaxy H1 cross power spectrum to the stacking signal that you expect. But that work is still under development. So in this case, we just opted for simulation-based interpretation. Okay, good. So it looks like I'm running a little close to the hour, but I'll try and speed up, and then maybe if there's questions after, we can go into more detail. So here is a slide which contains our model for this cross-power spectrum. Not directly implemented as an equation we fit, but rather this is the model on which our simulations are based, and then we derive the prediction for the stacking signal based on this model. The free parameters that we fit are the mean H1 density, omega H1, the linear bias of H1 and galaxies and quasars, a parameter which controls the strength of the nonlinear clustering. So this goes into the matter power spectrum here and just interpolates between a linear matter power spectrum and a nonlinear model. may also fit separately for the scales of fingers of God damping due to small scale velocity dispersion, separately for H1 and galaxies. And finally, in this cross power spectrum, there's a white contribution, which is proportional to the mean H1 mass per object in the catalog. And so we also vary this. This is the same parameter that was constrained by these GMRT analyses earlier. And we do have some sensitivity to this. However, it's highly degenerate with other parameters which control the nonlinear modeling. And so that's the situation that we're faced with. Now we can get more intuition for how this model works by plotting how the how the cross power spectrum between galaxies and H1 varies as you vary a selection of these parameters, and also how the overall stacking signal varies as you vary these parameters. Concentrating first on the left, if we had access to the entire range of K that we've plotted here, then we would expect to be able to distinguish between these parameters fairly well, simply due to the fact that they affect different aspects of the shape of the cross power spectrum. However, like I mentioned before, we've essentially filtered out all of these scales here, less than about K of 0.3 inverse megaparsecs or so. And the stacking signal is, you can think of it as a weighted integral over the balance of the cross power spectrum, which is left out here. And this integral tends to smear out a lot of the scale dependence, and it makes it harder to distinguish between these parameters. You can also see this based on the effect of the parameters on the stacking signal here. To zeroth order, these parameters all just look like amplitude rescaling of the stacking signal. And so this leads to a lot more degeneracies when we actually try to fit these parameters. Here is an example of the posteriors that we end up with when we fit this set of parameters, plus an extra parameter related to an overall shift in the peak of the stacking signal. This can be related to if there are systematic redshift errors on either the chime or the EBOS side, you can obtain a peak of the stacking signal at non-zero frequency. And so we fit for this offset as well. I won't go through all of the things you could interpret from this plot in detail, but let me just highlight a few rather quickly. I think I'm running. Well, Neil, how much time should I take left before I try and finish?
Maybe like a few more minutes.
I think right. I can get there. Yeah. Okay, let me just skip.
Or take more time if you need. Yeah, I don't know. It's fine with me.
Well, okay, I'll try and go fast, and then we can come back in questions if people have more. So let me just emphasize the one key feature of this plot, which is that there's a very strong degeneracy between omega H1 and the H1 bias here. This is expected. If you recall the expression for the cross power spectrum, you find that omega H1 and BH1 enter as the product, plus there's this extra Kaiser factor here. Now, since we know
Simon, can I ask about this first parameter, this delta nu? What's the units here?
Frequency.
So megahertz, you mean?
Yes. Yes. So
the fact that you're seeing this significant offsets of, 0.1, 0.2 megahertz, what would that correspond to in terms of, delta Z or something?
Oh, I don't have the conversion in my head.
Is it negligible, I guess, is my question.
It's not negligible. Yep. So for ELGs and LRGs, we find a negligible value for this parameter. For quasars, we find a non-negligible value. I think I have some plots in the extra slides. If you translate this into a velocity shift for the quasar redshifts, you find that this amounts to a systematic offset in the quasar redshifts that are measured by EBOS. And this is actually known to EBOS. And if you look in their quasar measurement papers, you find that they confirm this by comparing their baseline redshift estimates to some more precise estimates based on spectral lines in the quasar hosts. And so this, what we find is consistent with them, that there is actually a systematic offset in most of the, or an average systematic offset in the quasar redshifts, which acts to shift the peak of our stacking signal a little to the left on this plot.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Right. So the key thing for larger scale cosmology is this degeneracy here between omega H1 and BH1. Because we expect this degeneracy to be here, we can reparameterize our model slightly in order to try and remove this. In particular, we can attempt to derive, the best constrained combination of omega H1 and BH1 by taking the covariance between of the samples in the chain between omega H1 and BH1, and then diagonalizing it and finding the mode with the smallest eigenvalue. So this gives us a linear combination of omega H1 times BH1 and just omega H1 on its own. And you can interpret this in the following way, as an effective amplitude of H1 clustering, which includes a constant term here, which you can interpret as the average Kaiser factor. So it's some kind of angular average over all of the line of sight modes versus the transverse modes that we're parallel to. And it tells you the typical angle of the mode that you're sensitive to multiplied by this logarithmic growth factor. So this is the single cosmology dependent quantity that we really attempt to extract and interpret from this measurement. Note that previous measurements often in these cross power spectrum measurements that I mentioned earlier, they often just constrain a single amplitude, which is omega H1 times BH1 times some empirical parameter designed to soak up uncertainties in the nonlinear modeling. But we attempt to go a step further than this in making some rough parameterization of the nonlinear scales and then marginalizing over these parameters to ensure that we're incorporating uncertainty in the nonlinear modeling on this overall amplitude that we get. And so just final science plot that I'll show. You can also attempt to place a prior on the H1 bias and just translate this effective H1 clustering amplitude into a constraint on the mean density of H1 in the universe, omega H1. And so these are the results. This black line is a fiducial model fit to many other measurements of omega H1. And in the colored points, we have our chi measurements. So this plot looks kind of goofy. As you can tell, we need to extend the y-axis way up compared to all the other measurements in order to fit the chime constraints. A few things to note here. First is that the uncertainties here are dominated by the uncertainties in the nonlinear modeling, represented by our marginalization over all of these small scale parameters. If you perform the exercise of just fixing all of these small scale parameters at their fiducial values, we find that we could recover constraints on omega H1, which are of order 10 to 20%. However, we do this exercise not to interpret the central model, the central values here in detail, because we don't, we're not confident that our fiducial model for the nonlinear clustering is bang on. Instead, we just do this to reflect the modeling uncertainty, which comes from varying all of these nonlinear parameters. Second thing to note is that there is some prior dependence in these results. In particular, the way we parameterize the finger of God damping and attempt to compress the two finger of God parameters into a single parameter results in a prior volume effect, which tends to push the H1 amplitude to higher values. And so this effect is known, and in principle, you could try and correct for it by choosing a different prior for the finger of God parameters. But this other prior that you choose would be non-physical. So instead, we just choose to present the results as they are and caution that there is some prior dependence, which can be broken in principle by better measurements of large scales, such that you can start to break some of these degeneracies. Okay, so I'm significantly over time. So I think I'll just say very quickly, as our next steps in CHIME, our key focus is on recovering sensitivity to these large scales by implementing new methods for foreground filtering. In particular, we're working very hard on characterizing the beam better, such that power doesn't leak as much to high delays, and we can use a less aggressive filter along the frequency axis. There's also noise crosstalk between feeds within short baselines that we need to remove, and there are other foreground removal strategies that we'll pursue. Also, there's many more data that we've collected that we haven't included in this analysis, so we're working on that. And there are, in principle, other cross correlations that are possible with the same data that we're also working on now. So let me just leave my conclusions there. There are two papers you can read many more details in, the instrument overview paper and the stacking cross correlation paper. And I think I'll leave it at that. And I'm happy to take more questions. So thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Simon. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk.